The first big comment I want to make is that when we approach this subject, there are various assumed pathways and narratives about Africa. The first is the traditional past. Often this is the narrative used by anthropologists and those who are against mission. The traditional past is romanticized as a time of peace and harmony, in harmony with nature, and it was disrupted by the colonial project and by missionaries. And what we really need to do is to uncover Africa's glorious past. There's a second narrative, and that Africa is a moral burden, and it's Europe's self-appointed civilizing mission in Africa. This was captured in Rudyard Kipling's poem, White Man's Burden. Because, of course, the Africans were regarded as backward and civilized, uncivilized, and they needed either the gospel or civilization. And that narrative perpetuated even to the period of Ian Smith in southern Rhodesia, where he believed that we had to stay there for the sake of Christian Western civilization, whatever that might be. And then, of course, there's another image, and that's the tourist image of big game, inevitably Mount Kilimanjaro, with either an elephant or a giraffe standing in front of it. Big game hunters, Maasai warriors dancing with their beards and their shields, and tourists come and they buy pots and beads and anthropological artifacts, and that is Africa. There's another one, and that is darkest Africa, a place full of illness, trouble, strife, cruelty. And that phrase was coined in this book by Henry Morton Stanley. This book's 120 years old. In darkest Africa. And that's a very common image. We're going into Africa. In darkest Africa. There's another narrative, a more recent and quite a popular one. The hopeless continent. This was Economist's cover story in May 2000. The hopeless continent. And there's enough reason to believe that story. In Martin Meredith's book, The State of Africa, History of 50 Years of Independence, it's a litany of the shambles in post-colonial Africa, the Idi Amins, the Bokassas, the Gaddafis, and you multiply it on, there's enough evidence there. But it's also a tragic story because it ends so pessimistically. While one wouldn't want to disagree with the historic facts, at the end he says, his very last paragraph, the same lament applies throughout Africa. Time and again, its potential for economic development has been disrupted by the predatory politics of ruling elites seeking personal gain, often precipitating violence for their own ends. After decades of mismanagement and corruption, most African states have become hollowed out. They are no longer instruments capable of serving the public good. In fact, far from being able to provide aid and protection to their citizens, African governments and the vampire-like politicians who run them are regarded by the populations they rule as nothing but another burden. The hopeless continent. But then, in 2011, The Economist had another cover story. Its cover was Africa Rising. Africa Rising. Because there had been a fantastic period of growth. A number of African countries in the early 2000s were the fastest growing economies in the world. Africa Rising. I've got two books. Africa is Open for Business. And another one is called Africa Rising. So there's a hopeful narrative if we follow that trajectory. Just by the way, in the previous one here, the Time magazine cover, 1984, Africa's Woes, Coups, Conflict and Corruption. And now there's another model, and that is the two faces of Africa. Here's this magazine, Africa Business. The two faces of Africa, growth versus stagnation. It's not one or the other. These things are contesting for each other. And this economist of this year, last year, November, the leapfrog model is also a more hopeful narrative about Africa. Africa doesn't have to go through all the developmental stages that Europe and America went through. They can jump from here to there and cut out. And so that's one that's looking at the potential of Africa. On this section, I'll conclude with one other. Forget the economics and the politics for the moment. And as Christians, we need to view it differently, although taking on board the on-the-ground realities. We need to believe that Christ is Lord and that He will work out His purposes in Africa. He will build His kingdom. And I think we also need to consider the people. Yes, there's a lot of shambles around and graft and corruption, but my experience of meeting Christians in Africa, they're wonderful. You know, Kingsley Holgate, that guy who traveled around Africa handing out malaria nets and he did 1,000,000 miles, he was asked, Kingsley, all your experience, how would you summarize? And he said, the people are wonderful. The politicians are lousy. And I think that's a pretty good summary. The people are wonderful. So the next main section is to look at how the context of Africa impacts on theological institutions. And I'll just cite some of my own personal experience. In Ogbomosho, Nigeria, I was taking a staff training session workshop in the late afternoon, evening, when the electricity went out. And I looked around in alarm, but the Nigerians didn't bat an eyelid. They never missed a beat. They were so used to it. Because in Nigeria, in any one place, you were without electricity 80% of the time. And so we continued as usual, as if nothing had happened. And that soon taught me, don't bother with taking computers and PowerPoint presentations. Stick to paper. In the Ivory Coast, I was talking to the principal there, Dr. Keita. And he said, when the electricity goes off at night, he would leave his bedroom light on. Switch on. So that if there happens to be electricity, the lights come on, he wakes up, gets up, and he rushes off to his computer. Imagine trying to have a work schedule that is so episodic and disruptive. Very, very difficult. 2 years ago, I went to South Sudan. I was invited there by an African Inland missionary to work with the African Inland Church. They had a Bible college, but when Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army got chased out of Uganda, they went across the Nile into South Sudan, and they happened to occupy this Bible school. And of course, eventually when they got chased out again, they took everything with them. Doors, window frames, generators, picky motorbikes, everything. And the place was gutted. On my first visit to Bangui in the Central African Republic, I learned that a few years before, rebels from Chad had come across, attacked the city and had occupied the campus. And they were about to burn the library just out of sheer destructiveness. This library had 32,000 volumes. But the principal's wife was a Chadian. She spoke their language. And she was able to persuade them not to. It was that close. And over the subsequent 6 years, things improved in Bangui. And now they've reverted because of basically a civil war. And so the seminary there has had to move its doctoral program out of that country and into Cameroon. A little bit closer to home, think of running a seminary in Bulawayo when there was a gazillion percent inflation. I'm a very wealthy man. I've got at home in my filing cabinet, should be in a safe, I've got a $25 billion note. Trouble is, it's a Zim dollar note. And it's utterly worthless. Speak to John Stambouli. He was a finance man and chief administrator. How do you set an annual budget with that inflation? How do you pay your staff? How do you run an organization? Think of the stress associated with that. I think of a seminary in Bunia, in eastern DRC, which is closed for 12 years because of war and militias. And Dr. Carter, a remarkable man, he was told by the missionaries who had left the country that it is too dangerous to go back and that he should wait until he was given the go-ahead. He went anyway. And what had happened, the two warring factions were on either side of the campus shooting at each other. But they actually never invaded the campus. And then they retreated. And the people of the town said, you know what? The Lord was there. So they renamed the seminary Shalom. And the first time I went there, there was a big gathering on the campus. It was the townspeople talking about the supply of electricity. A very secular thing, but they wanted to be on the campus because the Lord was there. Today there's still a United Nations peacekeeping force in that town. There was a South African minesweeping operation to try and clear the mines around. And it's still very dangerous to go out into the countryside. Just last year, Dr. Carter wanted to visit a parishioner who was ill up in the hills where the militia were. So somehow he got a message to them to say, I'm coming. And they said, we know you, you're a good man. You'll be safe. Life is tough and difficult. Transport is always a problem in Africa. I remember one time I flew from Lusaka to Ndola to visit Tika. 3 days later, I went back to the airport to check in, and the airline had gone bankrupt. Freetown, Sierra Leone, is very hilly. So the airport is on flat ground, but north of a large inlet. So when you land there, you've got to get to the city. And it can take a 3-hour trip around by car. Or you can wait for a ferry, an old inter-Greek island ferry. And it's a bit like an African taxi. It just waits until it's full. So you've got no idea. It doesn't sail on schedule. Or in those days, you could catch you could pay for a helicopter ride. Cost $50 for 10 minutes. Absolute rip-off. It's an old Russian combat helicopter. And when I flew on it, it vibrated. And you know, when things vibrate, things come loose. And so I was thinking the door was open. That used to be the machine gunner's door. I thought, if something goes wrong, what do? Go down with it and swim, or jump out and let it fall? Anyway, my boss had traveled a lot in Africa. He said, Bill, relax, you've got to die of something. Thank you. But anyway, the British consulate forbade their staff from flying on that. And 6 months after I had been on it, it crashed, killed the entire Togo football team that had been playing there. And what had happened, the rotor blade had come off. The first time I visited Congo Brazzaville, I was with a German guy who was a lecturer in Namibia, and we had visas to enter the country. Great. So we arrived there, went to passports, the dreaded customs and passports. And the guy said, "Where's your letter from the government?" I said, "Everything your government asked for, I supplied, that's why they've given me a visa. Otherwise I wouldn't be here." "Nope. Where's the letter from the government?" The other one is, of course, there's a page missing from your passport. Where's the letter from the government? So we were detained. Fortunately, the principal of the college was on the other side of the barrier, and he said he'd go and get the letter from the government. Which is absolute rubbish because it was Saturday. Nothing's open. But about an hour later, there's a phone call to this customs official. And there's a member of the seminary board who's a general. And we were released with much great apologies. Now that's the way it works in Africa, not on the basis of law and rules and regulation. But if my man is bigger than your man, I win. And obviously the general was a big man. A few years ago, I was speaking to the acting principal of Cornerstone College on the Cape Flats. He is due to meet us, and he had come late. And he said that night there'd been a gang fight outside, lots of gunshots. And there'd been a knock at his door, and he opened the door, and there was somebody bleeding profusely. And he said this to me, "How do you do theology with blood on your shoes?" It's a nice metaphor for that, isn't it? So you can see how these contexts affect theological institutions. The last one is the relative poverty in many African countries. How do students afford to pay fees? And this is a big issue which we have to face, because we've inherited a model of full-time residential education from the missionary era. The missionaries were supported from overseas, they came free. They raised the money from overseas and they built the buildings. They bought the books from overseas. We have a model which is extremely expensive to run in Africa. And probably all of you know, there's a common factor when I was visiting these 40 seminaries. How do you get money from the students? There are a lot of people who want to study, but they can't afford it. We have a model of dependency which is not sustainable. It's a big challenge to find a way to deliver education which is cheaper than that. So from these examples, you can see that whether you like it or not, the context affects the process and the institutions. And it's important for us in South Africa because, relatively speaking, things work. I mean, 2 years ago at the conference here, there was a whole toying and whatever in Pietermaritzburg, and some people came late. That's quite mild. And it's just to help us to realize that our brothers and sisters in other parts of Africa are facing enormous challenges. You know, I always used to come back and said, these guys out there are heroes. They're heroes. And they pay a huge cost of stress, heart attacks, and other illnesses, stress-related illnesses. That's how it affects the institution. The second part of my talk is to ask the question, well, what are African realities? What is this context? And to do this, I quoted a number of sources. The Nairobi Evangelical Graduate School has a little division called ISAR, Institute for the Study of African Realities. And they produced a brochure. What are the issues facing modern Africa which the church must address? A short list would include, and they list AIDS, health and disease, especially waterborne diseases, economy and poverty, urbanization and modernity, violence in the home, war, trauma, justice and injustice, poor church and state governance, and education. Some years ago, there was the South African Christian Leadership Assembly, their second one, and they formulated a number of challenges facing the church in South Africa under the heading of giants, taken from Goliath, facing the giants to be defeated. And they list with AIDS, crime, violence, poverty and unemployment, family crisis, racism, sexism. Interesting, the family crisis is particularly acute in South Africa with a catastrophic breakup of family life. Because we started industrializing all with the discovery of diamonds and then gold and then industries, and with the migratory labor system, when men were away from their families for 11 months of the year, it led to breakup of family life. So South Africa really has a huge problem. It's never addressed particularly by the church. It's never addressed politically. It's hardly surprising that you get so much violence, because who is actually being a father to? You know, 40 years ago, I went to a conference in Johannesburg on Sunday school teaching. I was the only male in this group, and the other women were all Africans. And their lament 40 years ago is, how do we teach the fatherhood of God to our children who either have no father, an absent father, or a dysfunctional father? The experience of fatherhood, if it's projected onto God, becomes a terrible God. It's a huge problem. In the third source, I consulted the Africa Commission report. It was chaired by the then British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Trevor Manuel sat on it. It was an international commission, and their list was good governance. The big issues are good governance, peace and security, investing in people and education, water supply and sanitation, health and preventable diseases, HIV/AIDS, poverty reduction. And then the UN Millennial Development Goals has its own set. That's a global thing, but they all apply most acutely to Africa. Eradicate extreme poverty, achieve universal primary education, promote gender equality, reduce child mortality, improve maternal health, combat HIV/AIDS, malaria and other diseases, ensure environmental sustainability, develop a global partnership for development. Now, there's a big overlap between those. The ones that were listed only once were two on the Sackler list. They're particularly Christian, no, not particularly Christian, but Christian concerns, family concerns, and racism. Of course, racism is an issue where there's been settler colonialism, but in other parts of Africa, you could cross out racism and put tribalism. The inability to cope with the difference. The other who is different and therefore seen as a threat. So those are the realities. And you know that list I shared with the principals of 37 theological colleges, West Africa, East Africa and Southern Africa, in the same year. I said, here's the list. Rate the extent to which you agree that these are problems. And there was, mercifully for me, a very high correlation. They said, yeah, this is true. Now we can discuss this later from your own experience. Maybe I'm just a Malungu, what do I know about these things? So you can come back to me later. But then the next question is to look at, what are the causes? And this fascinated me, because as I asked questions, people gave a single answer, Africa is poor because, you know, one mono cause for a complex thing. So I started doing reading around, quite a lot of it, and here's an excellent book by the South African Greg Mills, Why Africa is Poor. And he starts to list some of these things. And here's one by a professor, an English guy, but at Free University of Amsterdam, Seasons of Rain. So just let's unpack some of these causal theories. The first is geography. That's a simple one. Africa has few navigable rivers, and so it's been very difficult to get into the interior. In contrast with the Rhine, the Volga, the Mississippi, St. Lawrence, Yangtze, Africa has few navigable rivers. You can't sail up the Zambezi. David Livingstone soon discovered that. Even the massive Congo River has a whole series of rapids, most inconveniently just 100 kilometers in from the coast. So you've got to go there, park your boat, unload, to go around the rapids, back on, and then continue your journey. Africa lacks an indented coastline so that the moderating influence of the sea doesn't affect it. Africa straddles the equator. The equator runs more or less through Nairobi. So half is north and half is south of the equator. So a lot of Africa is actually between the tropics, where it has high rainfall, hot sun, easily leached soils. And with that has come a whole host of tropical diseases. Malaria. I'm a true African. I've had malaria twice. Parasites, waterborne diseases. The point is made by way of contrast that the developed nations across the globe are happen to be in the healthier, temperate mid-latitudes. So geography affects it. Of the 42 countries classified by the World Bank as heavily indebted, 39 of them are within the tropics or in desert zones. So geography is clearly an influential factor. Secondly, the theory is based on the social history of the continent. And there are two that stand out. The one is the history of slavery. Now, one's got to be careful here, because Africa has suffered slavery long before the colonial period and the transatlantic slave trade. What's often avoided is the fact that Arab slave traders or Muslim slave traders practiced slave trade on a wide scale for a long, long time. It's not politically correct to foreground that. And then I discovered in reading this book by Baroness Cox, an evangelical who was a deputy minister in one of the Tory governments, this immoral trade, slavery in the 21st century. At least 27 million men, women and children are slaves today, worse than ever before, sex slaves, wage slaves. But, interesting little reference there to white slaves. Between late 1500s and early 1800s, around Morocco and the north coast, the Barbary and Corsair pirates used to sail around the European coast and capture Europeans and take them as slaves to North Africa. 1 or 2 million. There's a book written called White Gold. Slavery had been there in Africa, but what changed was not the fact of slavery, but the scale of it with the transatlantic slave trade. And it's estimated that maybe 11 million people were taken. And of course it was the young and the healthy. And it upset existing patterns, because another thing that's not politically correct is that those slavers would never have been able to get their slaves if it had not been for the cooperation of African chiefs. So the coastal chiefs were given guns and all of that. They became dominant. They could raid into the interior, capture slaves, bring them to the coast. But it's a tragic history because of utter cruelty of it. If slaves fell ill on the transatlantic passage, that is just cargo, throw them overboard. And I've been to Goree Island, off the coast of Dakar, the westernmost point of Africa, and there's a slave trading fort there, and at the bottom were the holding cells, and then through the thick castle wall is a door of no return. And you stand and you think of people who went through the door, out along the jetty, onto a ship, never to come home again. In my last visit to Angola, the students gave me a little carved statuette of a person sitting absolutely dejectedly, head in hands. I gather it's even on some Angolan banknotes. And it's almost an icon of a slave sitting on the beach, about to be taken off, knowing he'd never see his wife and children, his family, or his village again. Slavery. But the second social history is, of course, European colonization, which at first it was haphazard, and then it changed into full-blown imperialism in the scramble for Africa. Read Pakenham's book, The Scramble for Africa. It was regulated by the Berlin Conference in 1884 to 85 to stop the European powers going to war with each other to claim territory, somebody else's territory overseas. Now, one of the anomalies there is that Belgium got a big chunk of land in what became the Belgian Congo. But that was the personal possession of King Leopold. It wasn't a government thing, it was his personal possession. And if you want some chilling reading, read Hochschild's book here, King Leopold's Ghost. The barbaric cruelty of that regime, where they're extracting ivory and rubber from the Belgian Congo. And every village was given quotas, and if they failed, your hands were cut off. And people were shot. And of course, folk didn't like that so much, so they rebelled, and villages were burned down. And the calculation is that there were a few million people, 110 years ago, a few million people who died as a result of Belgian, of King Leopold's work. It got so bad, and as a result, by the way, of missionaries who in the early days of photographs, took photographs, as a campaign started, was mounted in America and all around Europe, such that the Belgian government actually had to take the Congo away from the king, and it became the state's possession. In the closing section of this, the guy writes in a postscript, he said, I think when I wrote this book, so it's a postscript, I had understated in this book the importance of evangelical tradition in the appeal of the Congo reform to the British public. I had overlooked the way Baptist missionaries had already started to draw large crowds in Scotland to magic lantern slideshows about Congo atrocities. Nice to know that the church was on the right side for a change. If you read the book Britain's Gulag, the two that came out in the same year, that looks at the way the Mau Mau was repressed. And so when Helen Ziller, that very experienced and wily politician, tweeted that there were some good things in colonialism, she was so politically unwise. She was factually correct. Schools started, hospitals started, roads were built, some railways were built, but the whole motivation behind it and the whole effect of it was extremely harmful. One interesting theory is that in the colonial era, colonial regimes ruled without a democratic mandate of the people. They were answerable to a far-off power. Only a few top officials were the beneficiaries of that system. And on that basis, they say independent Africa simply inherited and perpetuated a form of government that had been modeled to them, unanswerable to the people and for the benefit of the few. Under the heading of social theories, another is that Africa has a very high index of ethnic and linguistic diversity, distinct languages and ethnic groups. And for that, it means there are very many potential planes of cleavage. Another, based on that, effect of the colonial era is that boundaries were drawn of political states, sometimes just arbitrary, a line of latitude or follow a river, without any reference to the people on the ground. And if there's a river basin, it's likely that the same people are living on both sides. So in Kenya and Tanzania, the Maasai are split by a border. You get it in eastern DRC. So you've got people groups split. So they actually have got a cousin just across the border. Which makes, when there's wars, you get regional conflicts, because people across the border belong and have affiliation with those inside. People got split, but also groups got put together who were never naturally together. So in Nigeria, you've got a basic east-west split between Muslim north and Bantu Christian or traditional south, with 6 or 8 major language groups and another 100 subgroups. And so you've got countries formed without effective states. And in Nigeria, about the only thing that unifies the country is when their football team plays. That's the one symbol that they all can identify with. Otherwise, what is it that keeps the people together? It's difficult. The third cluster of causes are economic. Africa is an exporter of primary products and commodities that have low value per ton. They sent overseas, they beneficiated, manufactured, and sold back at much higher price. Why did South Africa send its diamonds to be cut and polished in Umfer? Why didn't we do it ourselves? Why is cocoa or coffee sent from West Africa to be refined overseas? And that's still a problem today. The colonial pattern, railway pattern, Google African railway networks. There's a nice map there. And you can see the imprint of colonialism, that the African railway network is from the interior straight to the coast. Africa is not interconnected by rail. And why is that railway pattern? That shows the purpose of the colonial era, was to extract resources from Africa, ship it to the coast, take it overseas. And unfortunately, that pattern is being perpetuated. Last time I was in Sierra Leone, there's a huge bauxite mine there, and the Chinese have built a railway line from the mine to the coast to feed the Chinese economy. So Africa is still a done to, exploited, extracted continent. One of the most interesting theories is that Africa is poor because of aid. This book by Dambisa Moyo spells it out. Every chapter, you see a lot of foreign aid comes in at the top to the government, and the President Kennedy's trickle-down theory simply doesn't work because there's blotting paper and sticky fingers at the top. And it doesn't manage to get down. And with massive amount of aid, it gets intercepted at the top. Talk to Joyce Bunda and what happened in Malawi. $60 million of it. And then the governments are more dependent and oriented towards pleasing the donor. They neglect their own tax base. And it distorts the economy. And the few get richer, and they steal that money from the top and don't reinvest it in their own country. They have no confidence in their own country. It gets sent out of the continent. So from Zambisa Moyo's point of view, aid has not helped Africa. Africa is poor because of aid. And related to that are the illicit outflows of capital by corrupt individuals. From 1970 to 2008, the World Bank estimates $735 billion left Africa. The incoming aid was $180. On that showing, Africa, which is poor, was the creditor to the rest of the world. And where did that money go? To Western banks. And the whole Western banking system is complicit in all of this stuff, eh? It couldn't happen unless there was a place to park that money and get your interest. Another social reason with economic implications is the brain drain. Ghana estimates that 60% of their doctors leave within 5 years. 80%. And with all the disruptions that happen in Africa, people with get up and go, get up and go. They've got transferable skills. Think how many skilled Zimbabweans have left the country. Economic refugees, political refugees, the skill base is eroded. A cultural factor with economic implications is, of course, some traditional practices. If a husband dies, the husband's family can claim the house, the cattle, a lot of the stuff, and leaves the widow with the children and no means of support. That leads to poverty. Another is what in English is called the tall poppy syndrome. You know, the flowers are growing up and one grows taller than the other and it gets noticed, it's different from us, so they cut it off. And we've had experience of that personally with our gardener and with our domestic worker who were trying to build houses. And our domestic worker took 6 years. She built her house slowly, slowly, looked like she's struggling. Because if she got the money and built it quickly, people would have said, hey, where she get the money from? It's those Malungus. Then what happens? In isiZulu, umona, jealousy. And the quick way to deal with that problem, you accuse that person of having special power. He must be a witch. And if you accuse the witchcraft, you're dead. You cut down people who are beginning to excel. Now I'm running out of time. I have run out of time. Just let me make one other big point. Another cause of poverty in Africa is geopolitical. Africa got caught in the proxy wars between Russia and the United States. Communism and capitalism. And if Russia made a move to support a country, America made a move against it. So Britain, South Africa got drawn into the Angolan War at the request of Henry Kissinger to fight the Marxist regime there, which was backed by the Cubans. It was our guys who died, not the American guys who died. So the United States backed Mobutu Sese Seko because he claimed not to be a communist. And they turned a blind eye to the massive corruption and kleptocracy because he is one of ours. And there's an African proverb, when two elephants fight, the grass gets hurt. We're seeing that same scenario being played out now in Yemen, in a regional power rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And it's the Yemenis who are dying. But there are many, many positive trends. The airline system has improved vastly in Africa. The cell phone uptake in Africa far exceeded all in industry projections. Google fiber optic undersea cables in Africa. The undersea cables are connecting Africa up the west coast, east coast to India and the east, and to Europe and America. Like never before, all in the last 20 years, government-run copper wire landline systems are hopeless. You know that. Copper cable gets stolen. Hey, but they can't steal the airwaves. So your cell phones are safe and work. There are many signs. There are far fewer coups than before. The African Union is gradually getting its act together. They've got their own regional peacekeeping forces. Just earlier this year, the AU was saying we need to be a borderless continent. Visas are such a problem getting across. It's inhibiting trade. And already 11 countries have signed up to allow visa-less entry. There's a whole plan for a railway network. So there are many signs of hope. Just the last thing to say, one of the great African realities is the church. It is the most present, ubiquitous institution at the grassroots. And while the growth in numbers is to be celebrated, the general characteristic that the church in Africa is a mile wide and an inch deep. The World Evangelical Alliance just last year did a survey of all pastors in the majority world, 2.4 million, and they're finding about 80% have either no or little theological training. So it's shallow, and it's ripe for the heresy, which is why that seminar yesterday on the prosperity gospel is so important. It's absolutely corroding. It's a far greater threat to the church in Africa than communism ever was. So I need to conclude there. I have a handout which will be given